Hello, I'm Nicholas Barrett.
I'm Maria de Meritis.
And you're listening to The Sound of Economics. Now, according to Mark Twain, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Around the same time, the Industrial Revolution was changing the world forever. The way we worked, the way we lived, and the way we governed ourselves would never be quite the same again. We now find ourselves at the beginning of the artificial intelligence stanza. How might the digital revolution of machine learning, quantum computing, and automation rhyme with the Industrial Revolution of steam engines, factories, and coal mines? Will our economy even need humans? Today I'll be making grandiose statements about the future of the human experience, cunningly disguised as questions for our guests. Carl Benedict Frey, author of The Technology Trap, and Robert D. Atkinson, president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. So, Carl, tell us about automation and the differences between the short-term experiences we'll notice and the long-term experiences.
Well, if we go back in history, living standards were stagnant for a long time, and they only really took off significantly in the late 18th century, beginning in Britain. And part of the reason was the mechanized factory, which allowed us to produce more with fewer people. And as a result of that, people in Britain and Europe are roughly 20 to 30 times better off in real incomes today than they were in 1750. But if we go back and look at the experience of the first industrial revolution as such, as the mechanized factory displaced the domestic system, most people didn't see the benefits from that straight away. The generation that lived through it didn't fare very well. And we all know about the Luddites who rioted against the mechanized factory, went out and smashed machinery. And it's become popular to refer to these people as backwards and opposing progress. But they were not the ones who stood to benefit from mechanization. So to some extent, their opposition actually made sense.
And people have argued that one of the reasons Britain had the Industrial Revolution was that the government was capable of using coercion to control people like Luddites. We even hung them. Obviously, we wouldn't want anything like that today. We wouldn't want to force technology with the threat of violence. But what can we learn about taking the best of technology for our economy without people feeling like they're being coerced into it and pushed towards it?
Sure. So labor coercion was fairly common in most countries that industrialized early on. So it wasn't just in Britain. But obviously, we don't want that today. And we can use our government and public policy to smoothen the transition. We can, give unions the right to bargain and, try to improve the working conditions for the people that they represent. We can redistribute income to some extent, create social safety nets, health insurance that help people that lose their jobs. And obviously, we can use the tax system as well to balance out the falling labor share of income that's taken place in most countries over the past three decades or so.
So, Robert, the first industrial revolution, the one we often refer to in the 19th century, changed every sector beyond recognition in Europe, more or less. Should we expect the same thing to happen with automation in the decades to come?
Well, I think it's important to understand the history. I actually don't think the first industrial revolution changed all that much. It was a relatively narrow set of technologies around the steam engine. And so you automated things like pumping water out of coal mines, and you got trains. But when you study the first industrial revolution, as opposed to the second was much more about mechanized factories. When you study the first industrial revolution, and this is, to be fair, there's a difference in the scholarly literature on this, but the scholarly literature that I think is right actually shows that people didn't benefit all that much, but not because there weren't the right distribution of gains. There just weren't very many gains. And we didn't really get the productivity impact until the 1830s or 40s. It was a combination of other things. There was the Britain war debts. They had to raise taxes on people. There were all these, there were famines. So the British economy didn't do very well back then. So when people say, well, it took 30 years for the gains to be, had, I don't think that's the right way to frame it. Once we got past that and then we had real productivity growth, you saw significant increases in wages for people. And I think that's exactly what is happening, will happen today. We have very slow wage growth today because we have very slow productivity growth. One last point, just to be fair. The British government didn't prosecute Luddites for being Luddites. They prosecuted them for property crimes. They went into factories that they didn't own, and they destroyed machinery, and that is a crime. And So I think we should do the same thing today. If somebody destroys property, they should go to jail. That's not to say that the government should oppose people who don't want change. I get that. I would add one other piece of that. I think the Luddites were fundamentally selfish. They were self-interested. Now, that's what people do. I get that. But they were not looking out for the interest of the overall UK economy. They were looking out for their own selfish interest. And I think it's important to recognize that today automation is going to be a very important thing for the European society overall to prosper. And it's, we have to differentiate between individual interest and societal interests.
Let's just stick a pin in the Luddites for a minute and come back to it. Maria, I was just thinking that if the major benefits of automation are a few decades away, but the disruption is going to hit us in the face maybe in the next few months or years, that's going to be a really hard sell to voters, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the fear. I mean, the fear is that the benefits will be difficult to capture, and they are typically intangible. I mean, in fact, it's interesting what Rob said about the productivity growth, because we're actually in an era where we see a slowdown in productivity, and yet we see an increase in all of everything digital, and the fear of automation and how this is going to replace jobs is real. So we have both a decline in productivity and a fear that our jobs will be gone. So, you know, where are the benefits going to come from? But I think you're right. Part of it is a perception. And therefore, I think here our two distinguished speakers today have something to say about, you know, how much of the fear is real. How much of the jobs will be replaced? Is this something we should be afraid of? Or is it really an opportunity? And it's just a matter of years before we retrain people to capture the new jobs, because there will be new jobs being created. And therefore, the whole thing will even out. But that, of course, is the big uncertain. And, you know, part of it is, how do we sell it?
Carl, even if our fears of automation are rational in the long term, could our political response put us at a disadvantage with economies like China that don't really pay that much attention to how ordinary people feel about technological advancements?
Well, yes and no. I think for sure, as mentioned earlier, labor creation was a part of early industrialization. But mechanization has continued for 200 years, and people in the 20th century realized that, you know, to counteract the social costs that were inflicted on the workforce as automation progressed, we needed a welfare state. And that has made growth more widely shared, and it has been beneficial to people on average. We've also seen a lot less labor unrest since, and we've seen less unrest in general. So I think, you know, capitalism with a welfare state has been a fairly good recipe for us, and I think that's important to keep in mind. With regard to the Luddites, I think it's important to remember as well that not even economists at the time thought that mechanization could improve living standards. So Malthus, Ricardo, Karl Marx had at least one thing in common, and it was that they didn't believe that the mechanized factory could improve the human lot, although for different reasons. And for Luddites who smashed machinery, I mean, it's not entirely intuitive why the next generation should be better off. So I think we should have some understanding for people that suffer from mechanization.
Yes, Robert, I mean, at least in Europe, yeah, welfare state's been in decline for the last decade or so. The state has been shrinking, and a lot of people who are younger than 40, for instance, thoroughly expect to have a material life that is smaller than that their parents enjoyed. So they have maybe a lot more to lose and a lot more to immediately lose from the effects of disruption. Is that something we should worry about?
No. And the reason we shouldn't worry about it, look, I think the only way that the future workforce, young people in Europe, could have a lower standard of living than their parents is if one of two things happened. Either productivity growth became negative, which has never happened before in American or European history. It might go down a little bit to 0.5%, which is where it's at now. It's never been negative. So the per capita output in Europe is going to be higher in 20 years. There's no question about that. And with automation and technology, hopefully it'll be a lot higher. So the only other way that they could be losing absolute ground is if somehow all the gains went to a few people. And again, you don't see that in history. You see periods where you get some gains going to the higher end. But even in the U.S., where it's sort of common now to make these claims that the average median worker or the lower end worker has not had any improvements in their standard of living since 1970, this is 79, that's what Piketty says. is just fundamentally wrong. And The Economist had a very nice piece on that, covering the new studies on that. It's fundamentally wrong. The average or median worker in the U.S. Has seen income gains of 30-40%. So I would be amazed if a typical worker, a young person in Europe, doesn't have a much better life than their parents.
I mean, I just can think, like, in 1970, somebody working as a janitor in a school in America could probably use that salary to raise an entire family. And it may have been a lot harder for them to afford all the things we take for granted now, like fridges and TVs and phones and so on. But you could have a comfortable, relatively what we would consider a middle-class life on one salary. That's very hard to do now. So I think if there's a perception of a slowdown in economic standards of living, that's probably why. So I think these anxieties are fair.
I think it's more of a question of what the standards you expected back then. So one of the reasons it's harder to raise a family now like that is because people's living expectations are so much higher. But again, if you look at the evidence, you take a typical worker like a janitor and maybe the bottom 10% decile, their living standards are higher today than they were back then. Now, the only real caveat to that is people without a high school degree have had a decline in living standards in the U.S. But if you have more than a high school or more, your living standards are better than they were 40, 50 years ago. And it's easy for us to lose sight of that, but people just are living better. And we forget about it. The average house size is bigger in the U.S. The number of appliances people own are more. The car ownership is higher. All of these things you would imagine are related to income. They are people. You see that. And so I think the biggest issue, as Carl alluded to, I think it's really two issues. One is related to inequality, and we haven't done a good enough job on that. And the other is really about transitions.
Exactly.
So what do you think? Yep. Are we victims of inequality, or are we victims of our own expectations?
Well, I mean, so I think that there's an element of truth. Where we are now is, you know, what affects perceptions is what we see in the economy. And actually we are, you know, at the tail end of a very big crisis, hopefully one is in a lifetime type of crisis. And there have been clear losses there and clear losers out of this crisis. And so the perceptions are really much affected by this. If you think, for example, just to give a very clear example, the young people's perceptions about debt are very different. And when I say young, I mean people who were children at the time of the financial crisis, and now they're young adults. They have been conditioned about the way they think about debt simply because they've experienced it. So, I mean, that will affect their perceptions about how the way they go forward and how they feel about their own welfare. So that's one thing. But, I mean, the numbers are what they are. I mean, the standard of living now is indeed better than it was in the 1970s. And the other thing is, again, what Rob said about the transition. We are actually in a period of time where we have important transitions that are happening, and the digital transformation is a very big input to that. It's not the only one. We are also having shifting in the forces of globalization. We have in the emergence of China that does things slightly differently. It's also going to affect that the economy will develop. But I think that is going to really change, if I may say, the business model in the future. And then the fear, which also affects the perceptions, is how quickly me as an individual can adapt my skills, my training, the job that I can find. How quickly can I do that, given that I'm not sure about the speed at which the technological transformation is happening? So that feeds into that perception that, oh, things are more difficult now than they were before. But in fact, of matter, they're not really.
Okay, but these prescriptions are very difficult in practice. It's extremely expensive to constantly be retraining the population to keep up with technology throughout their lives. And also, people are very attached to what they're doing now. People like truck drivers don't want to learn to code. They want to drive trucks. And if you say, well, a machine can drive your truck and it's going to be far safer and more efficient and it's going to be more profitable than you driving the truck, are they going to go back to university and learn to code? And, you know, who's going to pay for that? Or are they just going to park their trucks in the middle of the motorway and cause a national crisis until they get what they want?
Well, indeed, that's the fear. And in fact, that's a problem because, how quickly are we going to have self-driving trucks on the roads? And this is not fiction anymore. This is going to happen at some time when we have the infrastructure in place. So will we be able to retrain our truck drivers in real time to avoid the social disruption? That, of course, is a very important risk. But the the fact of the matter is lifelong learning is going to be the order of the day from now on. Jobs for life to do one thing are dead. We are all going to constantly retrain as technology.
Okay, so who's going to pay for that? Because I'm still £20,000 in debt for a degree that I finished a decade ago.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, society is going to have to put some safety nets there to try and pick this up. But indeed, that is a big thing for the welfare planner.
Carl, can we... Oh, no, sorry, go ahead.
No, I would maybe dispute the notion that most truck drivers want to drive trucks. Again, I'm looking at the U.S. data, which we've done. Truck drivers have the highest rate of disability of any job in the U.S. They have the seventh highest rate of on-work deaths. They have the highest rate of divorces, and they pay below the median wage. So in other words, not a very good job. And I think they're, frankly, would be good to automate a lot of long-haul trucking. I don't think it's going to be this notion that they're going to have to become coders. If you look at the history of job displacement in the U.S., which we looked at going back to 1860, and what you find using Bureau of Labor Statistics data every decade, and what you find is that the biggest job gains over time are not in these new occupations. They're in things like more restaurants or more schools or more doctors. They're just things that people want to spend money on. So there's a lot of occupations. There's a group, I forget the name of it, in the U.S. that a very good study. And what it did is it looked at current occupational risk, and then it looked at occupations that were adjacent. And so truck drivers are not going to be retrained. Now, some of them might want to be coders, but there's a lot of other jobs that are involve some kind of mechanical or other things that are close to that, that you could imagine them being retrained in.
Well, it's interesting, is it? Because I remember in school going on a school trip to a coal mine and thinking, this has got to be one of the worst places on earth. I would actually hate to have to do this all day, to come here in the dark in the morning and leave in the dark and not see the sunshine until Saturday. But, you know, when Margaret Thatcher, you know, challenged the coal miners union in the 1980s, it brought Britain to a halt. People really did want to keep their jobs no matter what the conditions were like.
I think they wanted to keep good jobs. Yeah. I think if you had given coal miners an opportunity to say, hey, you can either work in a coal mine or you could do this other thing in your community that's stable and reasonably well paid, I think my sense is a lot of them would say, sure, I'm willing to do that.
Carl, do you think we have to maybe reconsider the notion that work is the best way to redistribute wealth in society in the decades and centuries ahead?
I'm not quite sure about that. I think overall, I agree with what just had been said. Living standards have been improving over the past three decades, almost for everyone. On the consumption side, there's no question about that. What I think the key problem is that there are pockets of joblessness that have deindustrialized very rapidly. Economists tend to think that production is the consumption is the purpose of production, but we actually know that people put a lot of meaning to their jobs, and that is actually not true. So I think we need to be more concerned about these particular places which have deindustrialized rapidly. It's not just about occupational transitions, it's also about geographical transitions, and those can be very helpful, especially if you live in a community where jobs are disappearing across the board, and we know that a lot of social ills tend to come from that as well. And we've seen similar transitions in the past too, and they have never been painless, and I think that is important to recognize. But if we think that over the very long run, increasing living standards come from creative destruction, it comes from certain industries going down and new ones emerging, it comes from certain cities disappearing and new ones emerging, then we have to accept that. But we have to, as I mentioned earlier, smoothen the transition. So The key driver of living standards, both in terms of improving working conditions and both in terms of rising incomes and improving consumption possibilities, have come from technological change. But the short-run effects can be considerable. And we need to sort of, you know, provide cushions for people that fall in the cracks.
I suppose the interesting thing is that if somebody is upwardly mobile in a post-industrial region, they might go to college or university to train, and they might become skilled enough to move to a city where they can be more productive and more viable and have a better future. And then those mobile people, perhaps us, more globalized, more cosmopolitan, we seem to wake up after elections and find ourselves surrounded by ideas we don't like on the electoral map. And you have these kind of archipelagos of cities where cosmopolitan people live, and then you have these like huge swathes of post-industrial areas where anybody who's ambitious basically leaves and has every incentive to leave. And it's states are no longer big enough to have this kind of blanket investment in all these places that we can't catch up to. And it's hard to see how automation or artificial intelligence can reverse that trend when the business models they engage with seem to tend towards concentration, both geographically and financially.
Yeah, and I don't think it's desirable to reverse the trend either. I think if you look at creative industries, if you look at tech industries, if you look at financial services, all of those industries are highly clustered. If you look at cement production, it's very dispersed across space because transportation costs are very high. In knowledge-intensive industries, you have a lot of spillovers, and it makes sense for those places to be closer to each other. And those people earn very high incomes, and they demand a lot of in-person type of services, and that are also provided where these people live. And look, it's good for the climate that people don't commute too much. It would be better if most people live in big cities. And over the long run, it's a great thing, but it's a painful transition.
But the result is quite a polarized society, is it not?
See, I think we at ITIF, we partnered with the Brookings Institution to release a major proposal in December. It was covered widely by all the media, and there's now legislation in the U.S. Congress to implement it. And the idea that we came up with was to... We think, I agree with Carl, that the knowledge-based and tech industries tend to cluster, but they don't have to, in the U.S. at least, cluster just on the coast. There's an enormous number of places in the U.S. that they're not small towns, but they're some, Detroit, for example, Columbus, Ohio, Pittsburgh, St. Louis, all of these places could be viable tech hubs if the federal government were to make big investments over 10 years. For example, we proposed an initiative, $100 billion over 10 years, a lot of it going to research infrastructure at universities, but also training and other kinds of things. And we honestly believe that we could get companies like Amazon and Microsoft and Intel and all that to actually move a lot of jobs to the heartland. Now, those aren't going to help little towns. But I think, you know, the same thing up in the UK. You can imagine places like Manchester, you know the UK better than I do. So I think one of the mistakes we've made is we've just assumed, and a lot of economists just make this point, well, they should just move to Silicon Valley and learn coding. Not everybody wants to move to Silicon Valley. You know, they actually have a home, they have commitments, they have family, they have rootedness. And we've not respected that. And so I think that's one of the reasons people are mad. And so I think, you know, doing these kinds of things are critical to making sure that as a society we accept this creative destruction, but it's not so destructive that it, you know, really hurts and destroys lives.
And if I may add to that, actually one of the good things about the digitalization of work is that it has actually de-emphasized the role for physical proximity. I mean, you don't have to be at the same place all the time. You can do part of your job by just being far away. And actually, I think it makes jobs, the design of different jobs quite different, and actually encourages also dispersion of people in different places.
Have economists fetishized the upwardly mobile individual who's prepared to move states, countries, or cities for a better life?
No, I mean, I'm saying exactly the opposite, actually. I'm saying that there is the possibility of not having...
Oh, I know
move.
You are. I'm asking you about your profession.
Well, I mean, I think that there are agglomeration effects in the economy, and actually we've seen some of this. I mean, when you're talking about manufacturing, there are very strong agglomeration effects, which means concentration. I mean, you see it in Europe, that there are industries that are concentrating in parts of geographical parts. So there are benefits there. But as the digital economy, this is about physical jobs and manufacturing jobs, as the digital jobs, anything to do with data, for example, that will become the new thing, or is already the new thing, you might actually see different types of organization of work that don't actually conform to the traditional models of agglomeration.
Are we seeing new business models emerging throughout America and Britain in response to new technologies at the moment?
Well, just to go back briefly first, I'm not quite sure how desirable it is to try to revive these places. And if we look back, I mean, Venice used to be the biggest city, or one of the biggest cities in the world. And when we discovered the new world, it lost its clout in terms of its location. Liverpool was essentially built on Atlantic trade. When its harbor closed down, it essentially lost the sort of purpose of its location. And in the same way, you know, many cities today, it's not quite natural that they should be necessarily where they are. And if we look at some of these attempts at industrial revival. So you have the Tennessee Valley Authority, for example, which used new technology, electricity, dams, all sorts of things. And it did boost prosperity in the places where it invested. But the research suggests that it did so at the expense of other places. And America is spending, for example, more on place-based policies as and then on unemployment insurance. And I'm not quite convinced if that is well-invested money. That is not to say that we should completely forget about these places. I think we need to invest in the educational system there, improve schools. Early childhood education is going to be hugely important in those places in particular. And the good thing is, with human capital, people can take it with them. Physical capital stays put.
Yeah, but by investing in that education, you're essentially building an exit to those places. That's what you're offering people.
That's right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Here's a place I think we just are going to have to disagree. If you look at the history of how this worked out in the U.S., which we cover in this report with Brookings, you can pretty much take every single major tech hub. I mean, the notion somehow that there's revealed comparative advantage, and you just have, and once you've lost it, you should just, you know, pack up and leave and die. This is not the way that knowledge and innovation economy works, either at a country level or a subnational level. So you look at the U.S. without the federal government, Research Triangle Park in Raleigh-Durham wouldn't exist. Austin would not be a tech hub. San Diego would not be a tech hub. Silicon Valley would not be a tech hub. In 1990, Silicon Valley was the most defense-dependent county, the Santa Clara County, in the country. Boston. So the federal government has made places. It just hasn't always done it with the intent of making places. And I agree with Carl. There's lots of places in the U.S. that really have no future, or certainly not a future in the knowledge economy. But you look at a place like Pittsburgh, for example, where they're getting about $800 million to $1 billion a year in federal research funding. They have some technology companies. It's an attractive place to be. It just isn't quite over the hump. So I don't want to write off those places. The other thing, too, we have to remember is, so we've talked to a lot of venture capitalists and Silicon Valley companies and the like, and they all have this thing they call the second office strategy. So if you're a venture-backed firm, your first office is going to be in Silicon Valley. They always ask, where's your second office going to be? And if you say down the road in Silicon Valley, they laugh at you and say, no way. Your second office has to be in some other lower cost place. But where it is now, it's in lower cost places like Shanghai, Bangalore, Tel Aviv. And when you look at the U.S. now, the costs of going to Detroit are less than going to Shanghai. So I think we can create a viable second office cluster-based economy in the U.S., but it's going to take some conscious federal and state and local policies.
But you yourself, you've confessed that some places are just going to be left behind. And what will happen to them?
Well, again, to me, saying that some places will be left behind shouldn't be used as an excuse to say that every place should be left behind.
Oh, no, not at all. But
so
I mean,
Flint, Michigan, to use an example, I don't know what to do about Flint, Michigan. It's not going to be a knowledge hub. But Detroit could be. So I would much rather have at least some, another million technology jobs in the heartland. There's a other set of policies that we need to do for the Flints of the world and, some of the places that just are too small or too deindustrialized. But I don't think we should write off everybody who's not in London or, Paris or Berlin or San Francisco.
But, I mean, as long as there are places with, to use your words, no future, then we're going to have divided, polarized politics and unequal societies. Surely it's inevitable.
Well, but I don't think that's quite true. I think the issue is more, do we have a lot of those places, which we have now in the U.S., or do we have a few? The other piece of this, too, which I think is important to understand, if we could create a really good tech hub in Detroit, there are going to be regional supply chains that get set up. So that is, at some level will help the Flints of the world. You can be within 100-mile sort of radius or supply shed, and you'll do better. So when everything's on the east and west coast of the U.S., that's a big problem. So again, I think we just need to do more.
Yes, let me just comment on that quickly. So I think, we don't disagree that government could do things to revive places. I think where we might disagree is whether that is desirable or not. So if the federal government decided to put all research in Flint, Michigan, that would certainly help Flint, Michigan. The question is, would it be good on the aggregate? And the answer is probably not. And what a lot of studies suggest is when you invest heavily in one place, you redirect economic activity often from other places. So I think the question is, how good is that on the aggregate? And I think the evidence suggests it hasn't been enormously helpful. And I think there are better things that we could do, such investing in education and giving people cushions that, you know, fall through the cracks. I'm not saying that everything will inevitably cluster in Silicon Valley. I think that would be absurd. Of course, there are offsetting effects like congestion and things like that. But we don't really know how to engineer these places. There's a reason why we have Silicon Valley, and that has been the leading technology hub for half a century now. France had made efforts to create technology hubs. The Soviet Union or Russia did sort of very spirited efforts. And it's very hard.
Well, we do know how to do that. I mean, I wrote my dissertation on that 30 years ago, and there's lots and lots of literature. We absolutely know how to do it. We know how to not do it. Yeah, don't do it the Soviet way. But we do know how to do it. The reason it hasn't worked in the U.S. is because we haven't been able to amass scale. And absolutely, putting all the money in Flint, Michigan, dumb idea. But the proposal we have is to create a national competition that would be overseen by the National Institute of Standards and Technology and a board of experts. And the money would not go to Flint, Michigan. The money would go to places like Pittsburgh or St. Louis that already have research universities and tech hubs. And the last point is, absolutely, this would take jobs from other places. And thank God for that. Have you ever been to Silicon Valley recently? My son is moving to Silicon Valley in 2 weeks. And we looked at apartment prices online. Oh, my God. I mean, he's paying more than I'm paying for my house in a nice part of Washington. So lots and lots of Silicon Valley and Seattle and Boston, they would all be better off if they didn't have any more tech jobs. They would be much better off. They're choking on congestion. And then the other place that we're going to get those jobs relocated from is Shanghai and Bangalore. So instead of offshoring all of those to those foreign tech hubs, we can onshore them to U.S. tech hubs. And I think Europe could, frankly, do the same thing.
I actually wanted to bring the discussion to Europe because there is an extra layer of complication in Europe which actually prevents the smooth transition, which what it is inevitably, I think I agree with Carl who said that actually part of history, we've seen centers, you know, growing and actually declining. That's part of the normal decay of centers. But in Europe, the conversation is a little bit more complicated because while you may be able to afford to see regions die, you can't afford to see countries die because that is going to affect what I call the European project. I mean, you cannot have exodus of people, and we've seen massive exodus of people, of young laborers leaving countries and going primarily to Britain, but not only. And that has actually affected the ability of country, its own capacity to regrow, let alone what the country is doing. The people are leaving. So, you know, countries like Lithuania or Bulgaria, Romania, they have seen massive exodus of people. And the same is true for Italy, for Spain, for Greece that have been affected by the crisis. So, you know, the conversation there is, you know, do we allow certain centers within countries to grow in particular directions? The countries, what do you do about the countries? And that adds to the area of complication. How do you design policy such that you benefit from scale? Because effectively, this is about the scale effects. But at the same time, ensuring that there is sort of an equitable future for all countries around the globe, around the continent.
I mean, it's not just about that. It's also about competing with China as well.
Well, the emergence of China is part of this question because a number of jobs have been lost not to other regions in Europe, but they have been lost primarily to China. So yes, China is part of it. So the design of, you know, what can the U.S. Government do to reallocate jobs effectively in Europe has got that extra level of complication, which is effectively a constraint.
Because I mean, we're tinkering to try and design equitable, sustainable benefits from new technology. China can just turn up all the immediate short-term benefits up to 11 without consulting anybody.
Yeah, and that's an issue. And both the US and Europe actually agree on this issue that, you know, it's okay for China to develop and to become, you know, increasingly more of a developed country. That's within everybody's rights. The question is whether it's doing it what we call the level playing field. You will hear this word in Brussels a lot. Is it done at the level playing field, without using unfair competition? And there are issues with China. So the question is this system, can China continue to do this in the long haul?
Carl, is it possible that entire countries might be lost causes?
Well, I don't think so. But first of all, let me say, most improvements in living standards over the past century has come from countries catching up with the technological frontier. If we are humanists and believe that people have a right to improve their lives, we should welcome China catching up. And I find it striking that we're having this debate 20 years on. We had this exact same discussion with Japan. We had a sort of similar concerns with the Soviet Union before.
Japan is a democracy. China has concentration camps. Well.
Absolutely, but there was the same concern about Japan overtaking the United States and, you know, America losing its technological leadership. And it was the same concern with the Soviet Union, which wasn't a democracy. So I think we've seen this conversation before. I think it's very different of being a technology leader and or a leader in innovation at the frontier than being a country behind the technological frontier that can imitate and import foreign technology and grow very fast sort of through state capacity. And I think one reason that few countries have managed or no country has managed to overtake the United States is that that transition is really, really hard and we shouldn't be worried about that. And we should welcome China catching up. That is on balance a good thing. When it comes to Europe, I actually think we need more migration and not less. It doesn't make sense for people to sit around in southern Spain where there's 25% unemployment rate. They should go to places where there are jobs. But of course, that's really hard in the current political climate. And the European Union was built on the notion of convergence. And that convergence requires labor mobility. And unless you have that, it's not going to happen.
Can I just make a point on China? I don't think that is at all the issue. I don't even think President Trump believes that we should hold down Chinese improvements in living standards. Certainly, even the most hawkish China hawks in the U.S. don't believe that. The issue with China is much simpler. It's, are they playing by the rules? And the answer is unequivocally no. I mean, they have made a mockery of the WTO, and we wrote a long report on every single thing they committed to in WTO accession, and virtually every single thing they have violated. So when you're putting in hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars a year in subsidies, which the EU doesn't allow, we don't do in the U.S., when you force technology transfer, when you have a national spy service dedicated to commercial espionage, when you have cyber theft, when you forced joint ventures, when you subsidize. I mean, look at the recent study on Huawei by the Wall Street Journal. They showed Huawei received over $760 billion in subsidies. So I can see why all the European countries want to buy the cheap Huawei gear, because it's subsidized. It's same thing with rail, high-speed rail. It's subsidized. And Carl, as an economist, I think, you know, virtually every economist I know would say, if this was a domestic policy, we'd oppose it. We don't think government should be picking winners and subsidizing. We don't think they should be allowing weak IP protections. Yet that's what China's doing. And so to me, there's a real reason to confront China on these practices. If they could abandon these practices and grow, great, more power to them. But that's not what's happening.
Do you want to come back on that?
No, I think, I mean, I broadly agree with that. I'm not just entirely sure that that is the entire issue. And I do think that there are a lot of people in government that do believe that China overtaking the United States would naturally be a bad thing, regardless of whether they do it on a level playing field or not.
Great. Well, we are coming up to 40 minutes, which is the length of my commute, which means the podcast will have to come to a conclusion now. Before I let you go, if people find you interesting, is there anything you want to tell them about? Any Twitter accounts or websites or books, perhaps?
So, certainly you should buy my book. You can buy Carl's book, too. Carl's book is an excellent book, which I have just finished reading. The book I recently wrote with my colleague Mike Lind is called Big is Beautiful, Debunking the Myth of Small Business. It's an MIT Press book, and anybody listening can also just find more about us at itif.org.
And the Technology Trap.
I'll just second that.
Yes, available in all good bookshops. And thank you very much for joining us, Maria. Yes, thank you, guest Robert D. Atkinson and Carl Bendit-Frey. It's been a pleasure having you. Enjoy the rest of the day, and thank you very much for listening. Thank you for listening to The Sound of Economics. This podcast was presented by me, Nicholas Barrett, and edited by Tiago Almeida, and brought to you by the Bruegel think tank in Brussels. To read our papers and blogs, you can visit bruegel.org. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe on Spotify and iTunes, where you can also leave us a review and let other people know that we exist. And you can stay up to date with everything we do by following us on Twitter @Bruegel_org. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.